Alchemy. The empty nature of reality is revealing itself from opposite directions, through physicists looking into the core of the outer material world and contemplatives putting their attention on the essence of their minds. To say this differently, the inner empty nature of the mind is revealing itself not only through introspection, but also via the medium of the outside world through the revelations of quantum physics. This is reminiscent of Jung's insight into the ancient art of alchemy that the transformation alchemists saw in their flasks was actually a reflection of what was happening within their own psyche. There is something unknown in both the psyche as well as in matter. The concept of matter has undergone a great number of changes in the history of human thinking. Jung writes, "The real nature of matter was unknown to the alchemist. Inasmuch as he tried to explore it, he projected the unconscious into the darkness of matter in order to illuminate it. In order to explain the mystery of matter, he projected yet another mystery, his own psychic background, into what was to be explained." In other words, humanity tried to explain one mystery by unknowingly using another. In conflating these mysteries, the alchemist created confusion, as these two mysteries are in fact one and the same mystery being explored through two different approaches. This confusion led to the dismissal and rejection of alchemy, which coincided with the start of the modern scientific phase of history where mind and matter were completely severed from each other. This separation between mind and matter can be viewed as the separatio phase of the deeper archetypal alchemical operation writ large in and as history itself. With the advent of quantum physics, however, the possibility of a resolution concerning the long-standing mystery of how mind and matter go together has at last become available. As Jung reminds us, the unconscious, once it is activated, is projected into matter, which is to say that it approaches people circuitously from the outside. The fact that the unconscious appears projected into the seemingly outer world is therefore not surprising, as there is no other way by which it might be perceived. It is as if the psyche fleshes out its immaterial nature through the embodied forms of our universe. Pauli writes about the psyche, "From an inner center, the psyche seems to move outward, in the sense of an extroversion, into the physical world." Compare Pauli's words about the psyche to Stapp's words describing quantum entities. An elementary particle is not an independently existing, unanalyzable entity. It is, in essence, a set of relationships that reach outward to other things. Interestingly, Pauli completes his quote by saying that once the psyche extends itself into the world, the spirit serenely encompasses this physical world, as it were, with its ideas. The psyche, as a higher dimensional no-substance that is not located in the third dimension of space or time, is able to affect our ordinary lives and reveal itself by mysteriously interpenetrating into and synchronistically configuring our three-dimensional world. Jung writes, "At bottom, the psyche is simply world. Inhabiting the world, we find ourselves inside of the psyche, just like we do when we become lucid in a dream." Henry Stapp comments, "The fundamental process of nature lies outside space-time, but generates events that can be located in space-time. A higher dimension, whether it resides within the psyche or God knows where, is the repository of nature's core processes. The fact that the most fundamental processes of nature are not even located in space-time is a major clue indicating that an unexamined assumption that underlies scientific materialism is flawed and unnecessarily limiting. This underlying and tacit assumption is that the only things that are real are those things that are observable or measurable in space-time. Anything outside of space-time is considered to not only not be real, but to not even exist. The limiting and circular logic built into scientific materialism keeps those who subscribe to its viewpoint locked within the box of third-dimensional space and the treadmill of linear sequential time." The art of alchemy was based on and was an expression of a psychophysical unity. Alchemists had little or nothing to contribute to the field of chemistry, least of all the secret of gold-making. But only our overly one-sided, rational, and intellectualized age could miss the point so entirely and see in alchemy nothing but an abortive attempt at chemistry. On the contrary, to alchemists, chemistry represented a degradation and a fall, because it meant the secularization and commercialization of a sacred science. To understand the true meaning and function of alchemy, we must not judge it based on the potential chemical insights it contains. This would be tantamount to judging poetry based on scientific data that it contains or its historical accuracy. Jung writes, "Medieval alchemy prepared the way for the greatest intervention in the divine world that man has ever attempted. Alchemy was the dawn of the scientific age, when the demon of the scientific spirit compelled the forces of nature to serve man to an extent that had never been known before. Here we find the true roots. The preparatory processes deep in the psyche which unleashed the forces at work in the world today." Needless to say, this process of compelling the forces of nature to serve man had a shadow side. Modern corporatized science isn't so much interested in nature as it is, but rather what we can do with it, what practical use and profit can be derived from it. Commenting on the situation, Heisenberg writes, "The progress of science was pictured as a crusade of conquest into the material world. Utility was the watchword of the time." The purposiveness, according to Heisenberg, one of science's catchwords, of science, can lead to chaos if the purposes are not understood as parts of a greater whole, a higher order of things. In his book, Across the Frontiers, Heisenberg cites the following quote, "Purposiveness is the death of humanity." Philip K. Dick refers to this way of looking at the world, "What can I get out of it?" as use view, which he correlates with the fall of humanity. This use view perspective is expressed in English philosopher Francis Bacon's words concerning nature, which should be bound into service and made a slave. The scientific goals were to torture nature's secrets out of her. The essence of all forms of slavery is the belief that the slave, in this case nature herself, is an object separate from ourselves. When we view the world in terms of use, in seeking to overcome the world as object in order to enslave it, the world responds by enslaving us. Rather than viewing the world from the "what's in it for me" perspective, the words of Richard Feynman come to mind. "Our greatest advances come from researchers not aimed at use, but just for fun, curiosity, and desire for understanding." This desire for understanding is an expression of our true nature, which is not bent on dominating and controlling nature, but rather on treating the natural world as if it had an inherent value and life of its own. Along similar lines, Wheeler writes, "Fortunately, the human heart has the power to seize on the hard rock of truth for survival and jewel it over into a pearl, truth for truth's sake." In alchemy, the idea was that existing within matter was a spirit awaiting release. Alchemists were, in their imagination, helping to liberate this divine spirit. The benefit they received was only secondary. As Jung emphasizes, for the alchemist, the one primarily in need of redemption is not man, but the deity who is lost and sleeping in matter. Only as a secondary consideration does he hope that some benefit may accrue to himself from the transformed substance as the panacea, the medicina catholica. His attention is not directed to his own salvation through God's grace, but to the liberation of God from the darkness of matter. By applying himself to this miraculous work, he benefits from its salutary effect, but only incidentally. The alchemists weren't trying to get something for themselves through their endeavors. They were serving something beyond and greater than themselves that they felt was their very reason for being alive. The notion that there existed a spirit imprisoned in matter needing liberation is a symbolic reflection of what quantum physics has revealed. That is, that the world of physical matter does not exist objectively, separate from the consciousness. Alchemy is a timeless sacred art, as the alchemical art involves becoming an instrument for the incarnating deity to make itself real in time and space. Once they had found the gold, alchemists didn't feel that they possessed or owned it, but were rather its stewards and ministers. Alchemists were having the archetypal imagination that the deity had become imprisoned in matter, bewitched by its own genius for reality creation, and needed their help to become liberated. In other words, the sacred metaphysical art of alchemists was to liberate the creative spirit of the cosmos from the prison of matter. Creative artists of and for the soul, they were touching their own soul while being in service to the soul of humanity. Alchemists, Just like modern-day quantum physicists were a channel for the universe to autopoetically recreate itself in a uniquely evolutionary way. Quantum physics has unleashed this spirit. The question is, will this be recognized, and will it be used for the betterment or destruction of our species? What Wheeler calls the dream of the alchemists was to turn something of little value into something precious. The philosopher's stone, or lapis, was the fruition of their art. The lapis, Jung writes, is a psychological symbol expressing something created by man and yet supraordinate to him. The alchemists considered the stone to be the universal medicine, the panacea for what ailed humanity, the elixir of life, a rejuvenating and universe-transforming magical potion. It was the living stone mentioned in the New Testament, and was referred to as a stone that hath a spirit, and also called the savior of the macrocosm. Had the imagination of the alchemists simply run wild? In combining in one image a stone, a symbol of materiality, and its seeming opposite, spirit, they had conjured up what Jung would call a reconciling symbol, a symbol that reconciles and unites the opposites. In any case, there seems to be a connection between what the alchemists were pointing at and what quantum physics is illumining. This brings up the question, is the quantum the modern-day equivalent to the alchemical lapis philosophorum? Are quantum physicists, in their attempts at trying to find the secrets of living matter, and with this knowledge proceeding to transmute nature into something that it couldn't do by itself, unknowingly the living representatives of the ancient and sacred alchemical art? In one sense, the alchemical opus is a work against nature, an opus contra naturam, a work against nature which nature itself desires. The alchemists saw the prima materia, the primal matter, the chaos and raw material out of which the gold is made, as an imperfect body in need of being perfected. The alchemists, at least in their imagination, were helping nature do what she could not do herself. An alchemical maxim states, what nature left imperfect, the art perfects. Although the impulse to become conscious exists in nature, within the unconscious of humanity, a conscious human ego, an observer, is needed as a transformative vessel to realize and perfect this natural urge. In alchemy, as in quantum physics, the interaction between subject and object reciprocally transforms both parties. Jung encountered the historical counterpart of the psychology of the unconscious in alchemists. This is to say that the alchemical stages symbolically express the developmental phases of individuation, the process of becoming whole, of an individual. He comments, "The alchemical operations were real, only this reality was not physical, but psychological. Alchemy represents the projection of a drama, both cosmic and spiritual, in laboratory terms." As Jung realized, the entire alchemical procedure could just as well represent the individuation process of a single individual. There is something in the unconscious of humanity that is wanting to become conscious, and it found in both the operations of alchemy and the experiments of quantum physics a hook that attracted it so that it could express itself in some way. To put it simply, alchemists had unconsciously stumbled onto and were participating in what centuries later quantum physicists were tapping into, that what we experience as matter is inseparable from our own mind. The alchemist, Jung continues, experienced his projection as a property of matter, but what he was in reality experiencing was his own unconscious. Such projections repeat themselves whenever man tried to explore an empty darkness and involuntarily fills it with living form. Any prolonged preoccupation with an unknown mysterious object acts, in Jung's words, as an almost irresistible bait for the unconscious to project itself into the unknown nature of the object and to accept its resultant perception as objective. The more enlightened alchemists and quantum physicists were beginning to realize that what they were seeing was not objective, but was rather a mirrored reflection of the nature of their own minds. For alchemists, matter had a divine aspect. The alchemists, to quote Jung, saw their soul not in themselves, but in chemical matter. The prima materia is the famous secret and the basis of the entire alchemical opus. The prima materia is called radix ipsius, root of itself. It is an in creatum, a transcendent creation, an uncreated, autonomous, self-generating, spirit-like entity which is rooted in itself, is dependent on nothing as there is nothing outside of it, and has everything that it needs. Without beginning or end, and in need of no second, it can by definition only be something of a divine nature. The noted alchemist Paracelsus conceived of matter as being an increatum, thereby coexistent and coeternal with God. The prima materia is related to the God image of the alchemists, Mercurius, who, interestingly enough, begets himself. Notice the similarity to Wheeler's idea of the universe as a self-excited circuit. Similarly, Philip K. Dick writes about reality experienced as a unified self-governing field. It initiates all its own changes acausally in synchronization. Not knowing what they were trying to articulate, truly not knowing what they were talking about, the unconscious itself was simultaneously living through the alchemists as it revealed itself to them. Is something similar happening in quantum physics? Something in the alchemists' and the quantum physicists' minds wanted to make itself known and become conscious, and it projected itself into matter to do so. The self, the intrinsic wholeness of the human psyche, wanted to actualize itself, so it created the art of alchemy and the field of quantum physics as a medium for and symbolic expression of its realization. There is an alchemical saying, solve et coagula, dissolve and coagulate, which corresponds to the alchemical operations solutio and coagulatio. Alchemists were dissolving and regenerating elements of their experience both over time as well as in each and every moment, so as to potentially distill, reconstitute, and create something new. Jung, who many consider to be a modern-day alchemist, writes, I take these thought forms that have become historically fixed, try to melt them down again, and pour them into molds of immediate experience. De-solidifying, de-literalizing, and deconstructing their experience in each moment empowered alchemists to actively participate in their own transformation and evolution. Alchemists saw the essence of their art as both analytic and synthetic, as it involved separation, discrimination, and analysis on the one hand, and synthesis, consolidation, and integration on the other. As previously mentioned, physics can be considered a form of art. Though their coupling at first seems strange, art and physics might be an example of Bohr's idea of complementarity, where two seeming opposites actually complement and complete each other. On the surface, physicists break down nature into its component parts and analyze the relationship of these parts, whereas artists synthesize different levels of reality such that the work of art is greater than the sum of its parts. Physics isn't all about analysis at the exclusion of synthesis, however, while art isn't solely about synthesis while having nothing to do with analysis. Both disciplines are alchemical in the sense that they partake of a continual back and forth of analysis and synthesis, of dissolving and coagulating their experience. Theologically speaking, the shape-shifting Mercurius could be considered to be a further emanation of the resurrected body, using the creative imagination of the alchemists as its vehicle of incarnation. Similarly, the quantum could be the modern-day iteration of the alchemical glorified body, corpus glorificationis, the philosopher's stone, an incorruptible subtle body that is simultaneously using the canvas of the physical world, the art of physics, and the mind of humanity as its joint instruments of revelation. Similar to how alchemists dreamed up Mercurius as their image of divinity, have we, as modern people, dreamed up the quantum to reflect back something similar in ourselves? In any case, both alchemists and quantum physicists are potentially having the epical, revolutionary, and evolutionary realization that we play a crucial participatory role in how things turn out. As Jung points out, we don't want to be like the foolish Parsifal who forgot to ask the vital question because he was not aware of his own participation in the action.